Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, affirmative action going. The United States as the world's leading middle class, gone. We'll get to the Supreme Court affirmative action case shortly and the moral challenge it poses for white America. White Americans, listen up, because the court said, white America, affirmative action is up to you. Go vote on it state by state in referenda. White America will explain and take your calls. But first, you can stop making fun of Canada now. A new data analysis by the New York Times finds the American middle class is no longer the wealthiest in the world. Guess whose is? David Leonhardt is the lead reporter and number cruncher on this, and he's going to join us in a minute. The article declares that the U.S. no longer has the world's wealthiest middle class. Canada has passed us. Other countries' middle classes are also catching up to ours. They feature a chart comparing growth in median income since the year 2000. Listen to this, folks. Britain and Canada had 20% growth in median income, right? That's, you know, half the people are above that line, half the people are below that line. 20% growth in the median income spot over the last 14 years in Britain and Canada. The Netherlands, 16%. Ireland, right around there. The United States, 0.3. Median income flat in the United States since the year 2000, while it's growing in other Western industrialized countries. Britain and Canada, 20%. The Netherlands, 16%. Ireland, I don't have it in front of me. I think it was 13%. Even struggling Spain had 15 times as much median income as the U.S. And you know Spain is one of the hardest hit in Europe's financial crisis, with more than 4% growth in median income in Spain, however, compared to 0.3% in the United States. So this has been this is about a deteriorating – this is not about, I should say, according to the article – a deteriorating economy overall in the United States. It is a different distribution of our national income than in the past, because this data analysis by the Times finds that the U.S. is still the largest economy, and yet the middle class is thriving more in these other countries that we tend to compare ourselves with. In fact, maybe we can do a call-in for immigrants here. If you have been what you like to consider middle class in more than one country, call in and compare the experiences. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Canadians, hello Canadians, are you listening in Canada right now on the web? Are you a Canadian expat who lives here in the New York area right now? Call us and boast about the rise of the Canadian middle class. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In fact, seriously, maybe some of you with Canadian ties can give us a little cross-cultural, cross-economic, cross-political analysis here. Why do you think Canada has surpassed the United States as the country with the wealthiest middle class now? 212-433-9692. And I think by that, David Leonhardt and his colleagues at the New York Times mean the best standard of living, the highest economically measured standard of living among middle classes of the world. By that measure, Canada has surpassed the United States just in the last few years. 212-433-9692. And the poor are getting poorer in the United States compared to the poor in other countries. How do they measure that? Well, the article says a family at the 20th percentile of income distribution in this country, that's poor, 20th percentile, makes significantly less money than a similar family, a 20th percentile family in Canada or Sweden or Norway or Finland or the Netherlands. And 35 years ago, the reverse was true. the 20th percentile poor American family made significantly more money than 20th percentile families in Canada, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the Netherlands. So it has flipped. Is it market forces? Is it policy choices? What kind of mix? David Leonhardt cites education as one of the factors. The U.S. is getting worse at educating people relative to other countries for the skills that are needed in today's economy. That is certainly a change from years ago. 212-433-9692. And David in Long Branch, you're on WNYC. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Brian. I'm going to turn off my reception here so I don't interfere with our dialogue here. I'll give you some brief information about myself, okay?
Sure.
I don't want to mention the name of the dealership. I'm in the car industry.
Okay.
For the last 20, 30 years, okay?
Uh-huh, you're a car salesman?
I work for a luxury dealership in New Jersey.
Got it.
I won't mention the name.
Okay.
When you talk about why income has been well below the what's necessary to exist, I'm working at a dealership, as an example, where pay raises to the clerical people have been non-existent for approximately the past 7-8 years. Salary and income on sales is well below the average in relation to other car dealerships in the industry. They're in a position, management, to do that because they feel that with the power that they have, they're able to use these these methods to keep your income at a certain level.
What's the power that they have?
Is
the power that they have that you referred to just the fact that there are so many people who would gladly step into your job that they don't have to give you a raise?
I think you pretty much hit it right on the head. Because of the power that they wield in the industry, it's a high-profile dealership. They're well-known. Again, they have extraordinary power in relation to the people working
right.
at their dealership.
But then to be
Therefore,
clear,
they just they see the people working there, rather than take a chance on losing their job,
right.
will more or less just go along
but,
with whatever
but then, David,
the
to
employer
be, to,
is offering you, each year.
To be clear, before I move on and hear somebody else's story,
sure.
are you describing a situation that's particular to your company because this dealership at this high end of the market can do that, or are you describing something that you think reflects a larger condition of middle-class Americans today?
Well, I'll be honest with you. From my perspective, having been in the industry since 30-some-odd years, I think it reflects that particular dealership, which is part of a huge chain following nationwide.
Right. Okay. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Maybe a little corner of the winner-take-all economy there from David in Long Branch. Katie in Brooklyn, originally from Canada?
Yes. I've been living here for 15 years now, and my husband and 4 children and I are considering moving back to Canada because it's just getting too hard to be middle class here.
What do you guys do?
We're both artists, and we do very well as artists in New York City, and we actually do a lot better than a lot of our friends in Canada. But we have higher living expenses. We have to pay for health care. We have to pay for things that my peers in Canada don't have to worry about. And that really takes its toll. And that's one of the reasons that I think that the middle class in Canada is doing much better.
Thank you very much, Katie. And now we have David Leonhardt, the New York Times reporter, who put this number crunching and narrative together on the Times website yesterday where it first appeared. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be on.
So to back up a little bit and begin where your article begins, you declare the U.S. to no longer have the world's wealthiest middle class. What does that mean, wealthiest middle class?
Well, for if you go back to 1980, and we included this chart in online with the article, in some ways it's my favorite summary of the whole article. If you go back to 1980, at virtually every point on the income distribution, Americans had the highest incomes in the world. So if you looked all over the rich world at the 20th percentile, where someone is making less than 80% of the population in their own country and more than 20%, Americans there were richer than Swedes there in their country, or Brits or Canadians. And what's happened over the last 35 years is slowly the U.S. has lost the lead in the entire bottom half of the income distribution. So if you're looking at the poor in our country, they now make less money. They have less income. We can talk about the definition if you want. After-tax income than the poor do in Canada or Britain. And what has happened in the last couple of years, in 2010, Canada tied the U.S. for having the highest median income in the world. And Canada has almost certainly passed us since 2010, based on the trends in the two countries. Which Americans still lead the world? The rich. Our rich make more money than anyone anywhere else. And I just found it really striking, because I think for a long time, Americans have accepted the idea of inequality because we feel like, yeah, you know what? Our rich are richer than anyone else. But our middle class and our poor are too. And this data, which comes from surveys in many countries over 35 years, really calls that into question.
So you talked about that 1980 measure. What really jumped out at me, or one of the things, is your chart comparing growth in median income since the year 2000. I mentioned this before you came on. Britain and Canada had 20% growth in median income since the year 2000. The Netherlands, 16. I think Ireland was 13. The U.S., 0.3, flat in median income, while these other countries that we tend to compare ourselves to galloped ahead. Why is median income the relevant measure there?
Because the measures we see most often are average income. When you hear per capita GDP, that's essentially a measure of average income. And average income has a big problem, particularly at a time of high and rising inequality. Imagine that everyone in Seattle from one year to the next didn't get any raise at all, but Bill Gates made an extra $100 million. What the average
sure when you show, when you add it all up and divide by X all the people in Seattle, it looks like the average income went up.
Right, but that doesn't describe the experience of most people, right? And median does. What it does, or it does much better. What median does, it says we're going to line everyone up, we're going to look at the person in the very middle based on income, and then we're going to tell you what's happened to income at that point over time. And so what we see basically is that over time, incomes are just not growing very rapidly in this country. They did grow from 1980 to 2000, but they've essentially grown almost nil, as you noted, since 2000. We've had weak economic growth, and the economic growth that we have had, the spoils of it have gone to a relatively narrow slice of the population.
Tanya in Brooklyn, originally from the UK. Hi, Tanya. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
I consider myself middle class, or would have been considered middle class in the UK by virtue of my higher education, my parents having white collar jobs, owning their home. And I've been here for 15 years, and I just sort of find there's this strange delusion that everyone here thinks they're middle class, which is patently not true, especially around election time. Politicians tell everyone, oh, you're middle class, yet there's no support of the middle class. And it just seems strange to me that there isn't that support needed, especially in big cities like New York City, where if you have a family, you really can't survive on a sort of average middle-class salary.
Do you think the politics of mentioning the word poor are different in the UK? My sense is that in this class, politicians always run on the middle class, as you say, for a few reasons. One is the middle class is just seen as bigger and more likely to vote than poor people are. But also, poor is not just an economic condition. It's a stigma in this country,
right?
Because middle-class people tend to consider poor people poor because of merit, of lack of effort, that the poor are undeserving poor. Is it different
in the
UK?
I think that's a really kind of American attitude. And I think in the UK, there's some pride in being blue-collar, and there's pride in being working class, but I don't really find there is here. And I just sort of wonder where, you know, it's all going to go. And I sympathize with Katie and sort of think about moving home, because I just feel like the middle class is shrinking so much here. And without that middle, I mean, not a historian, but without that middle tier, mm-hmm. you know, how do the working class aspire to something but greater? And how do the rich have that sort of safety net if the bottom falls out for them? It's just without that. You know, you're Saudi Arabia. You've got the incredibly rich and the incredibly poor, and that doesn't seem to me like something to aspire to.
Tanya, thank you so much. David, I saw middle class and I saw poor as categories in your article. I didn't see working class the way Tanya used it, people who work with their hands, that kind of thing. Is it different in the UK and you here? Is there a working class metric that you use or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, those terms are really interesting. And obviously, middle class and poor are imprecise terms, right? What we, if you go into our data, what you see is our data doesn't have middle class or poor in it. It has all these percentiles over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the article, we use poor, middle class, and high income or affluent or rich. I've looked at the polling on this, and there are a sizable number of Americans who describe themselves as working class. I guess I have a hard time figuring out, well, what's the difference between middle class and working class? In a way, this is a semantic discussion, but in a way, working class is a slightly different category of definition, right? And so we stuck with poor, middle, and high income because I feel like all of them just reflect level of income, whereas I think a lot of people think of working class as having more than just kind of income, but it's amount of income, but also kind of job. And so I guess I worry a little bit that when you introduce working class or middle class in basic definitions that people aren't exactly sure what you mean. But I agree it's an important and useful concept.
Rama in Princeton, originally from India. Rama?
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I've actually lived in this country for 20 years, and we maintain very close ties with home. So, and I did come from a middle-income family in India. I actually had a question as well as a comment.
Sure.
My question is that this metric that that we're looking at, has it been adjusted for inflation? For example, in Canada, you say that there's been a 20% rise in income. But what has the corresponding inflation been? I mean, in real terms, what does it mean?
Right. And you do correct for inflation, right, David?
We do. All countries, we correct for inflation. So these are real earnings. So if someone gets a $10 raise and the cost of the goods they buy go up $10, then we show them as getting no raise at all.
Right. So simple answer to that question, which is yes. Rama, thank you. But I have another one. If you're labeling the poor here as having less income, people at the 20th percentile of income in this country having less income than people at the 20th percentile in these other countries, does that measure take into account all the government benefits and tax credits for people in the various countries? Food stamps, Section 8 housing vouchers, Medicaid, whatever, and whatever the equivalents are there?
I love methodology questions. So you'll have to cut me off if I go on too long.
That's why you started a new data site on the New York Times.
Exactly. And I would say that in addition to the article, we've posted a lot of stuff on methodology. So if people are interested, you can get much more detail than I'll be able to give here. It includes many of those things, but not all of them. Here's the relatively easy way to distinguish. They do include inflation. They do include taxes, so we subtract taxes. And we do include direct benefits. And when I say we, I should really be saying the Luxembourg Income Study, who did this data crunching, and we worked very closely with them. They're connected to the City University of New York Graduate Center. So basically, cash, money, excuse me, is all in there. We take out taxes, we put in Social Security, we put in tax credits, stuff like that. What's not in there are non-cash benefits and sales taxes. And those two things for the United States versus other countries actually kind of cut in opposite ways, which makes me think these trends would be quite similar even if you included them. People in other countries tend to pay higher sales taxes than we do because they have these taxes called VATs. However, as I think your question was implying, they also tend to get benefits that aren't cash that are more valuable. So we're not including any of the government health care that people get in other countries or in this country. We're not including any of the employer health care that people get in this country. And given what a big expense health care is for people, I think the way to think about that is that Americans tend to face higher out-of-pocket costs for health care and health insurance than people do in other countries. And these numbers don't reflect that. And so if we had the perfect numbers, they would also reflect sales taxes and all that health care stuff. My guess is they would look pretty similar.
David Leonhardt from the New York Times, our guest. He's the editor of the brand new section there called The Upshot, kind of a number crunching data journalism section, looking at the numbers in this first article comparing the middle class in the United States and other industrialized countries and the poor in the United States compared to other industrialized countries, and finding, if you're just joining us, that Canada has passed the United States as the country with the world's wealthiest middle class, and that the poor in the United States, 20th percentile of income and below, are doing worse than a large number of other Western industrialized countries in terms of yearly income, and that's the reverse of what it was a few decades ago. So now we're going to get from the statistics themselves, which we've spent the first part of this segment on, to the why question and what do we do about it question. Our comments page is flying with theories. I know you have yours in the article. And we will let Mike in Rockland County start off this phase of the conversation with why he thinks this may be happening in the U.S. Mike, you're on WNYC.
Hey, good morning, Brian.
Morning.
Just wanted to say something quick because I got to go back to work. But yep. I think the income disparity that we're seeing in the middle class of the United States is due to the central bank pumping so much resources into the stock market. And that's usurping all the resources from the rest of the economy.
Quantitative easing, pushing national income towards stock owners. One theory. Gloria in Westchester, you have another?
Yes. I would like to know if this disparity in income is due to the trickle-down economics that Reagan imposed 30 years ago that never trickled down.
Thank you. And Lisa in Montclair, you have another theory? Lisa, you there? All right. So David Leonhardt, here we go. Is this deterioration of the middle class in the United States compared to other Western countries, is this a matter of policy choices or a matter of market forces?
Well, I think it's probably a lot of it has to do with policy choices. We should start by saying it would be impossible to diagnose exactly what's causing this. It almost certainly involves a variety of factors. But I think market forces exert their power on all countries all over the world. And so then you should need to ask yourself, what's the difference among these countries? And I think in that case, policy choices are it. I don't think it's quantitative easing. In fact, some of these other countries have been more aggressive about monetary policy than the United States has. And these trends start long before we had quantitative easing or anything like it. We think that the evidence points to a couple different factors. So one is education. I do not believe as a coincidence that you would see these same trends in education. We used to lead the world by a wide margin in middle-class income. We used to lead the world by a wide margin in educational attainment. We don't anymore on either. The fact is that while you sometimes read some scare stories about how education isn't worth it, the gap between college graduates and everyone else is at an all-time high, and the countries that have had the biggest gains in income have had big gains in education. We haven't. The OECD just came out with this fascinating, it's this group in Paris, an organization of researchers from rich countries that study rich countries, fascinating and deeply depressing study in which they looked at people's literacy, numeracy, and technology skills around the world. And our 55 to 65-year-olds, American 55 to 65-year-olds, are the most skilled in the world. Our younger adults are not the most skilled in the world. And the fact is that matters. And so I think education is a big part of it. And then I think there are a whole bunch of other things as well. We have a lower minimum wage than other countries. We redistribute less income to the poor than other countries do. Our CEOs and top executives make a lot more money. And our economic growth isn't higher, right? So think about two hypothetical companies. They both have the same profits, same growing profits. At one, the executives make a lot more than the other. Well, at that one, there's less money left over to give to the workers. And to some extent, that first company is a little bit of a microcosm of the American economy.
And that's a values question, isn't it? If it's acceptable here to give a larger proportion of companies' revenue to the CEO than it is in the Netherlands or the UK or Canada, that says something about who we are and a choice that we make as a culture, doesn't it?
Yes, that is not a policy question. That's an important point. That's about cultural norms and values.
Let's take one more call, and let's call this person, Bill in South Plainfield, someone in a mixed marriage. Is that right, Bill?
Yes. My wife's Canadian. I'm a Canadian resident in Kitchener, Ontario, and I come originally from South Plainfield. That's where I'm calling from, visiting my folks.
All right, a U.S.-Canadian marriage. Go ahead.
Yeah, my wife started as a low-income person when I first met her. She, due to her efforts, she's actually in the middle class now. I'm a military retiree. I was earning pretty well in the last decade due to my being called up to active duty. It really gets to me, the idea that what's being said. I mean, the thing about Canada is their healthcare system, with all its problems, they've put money into it, especially in their hospital system, and that helps them maintain the middle class status. I know somebody who needed a very important procedure, and he was seen all the way through that. I don't think his result would have been quite as good, you know, being that he actually was a student who had a serious medical condition. In this country, a lot of the money's tied up in the military system. I'm smart enough to realize that benefits me personally, but it probably hurts the society as a whole. When they had their problem with their balance of payments up in Canada, they went into the healthcare system. They sort of downgraded that a bit. Paul Martin and Chrétien, but they strengthened their economy that way. Then they were able to bring their healthcare system back to a certain point. The thing about that is that when you invest in the healthcare system, you're adding value to the economy. Unfortunately, yes. Our military spending doesn't always do that for us.
Bill, thank you very much. Thank you for your service, and good luck to you and your wife as American Canadians. To wrap it up, David, and we're out of time, and we could do this conversation all day. But your whole project, the Upshot, is part of a new New York Times unit?
Yes, it is. We're really excited about it. The Upshot launched yesterday. We had this big story on the middle class. We have a huge model where people can go in and look at what's going to happen in the Senate races this year and play these really fun spinners to randomize it. And we've got much, much more coming. We've got stuff on Thomas Piketty coming on our site today, stuff on the gender gap and pay.
And boy,
thanks for having me on.
Data is the thing, right? I mean, Nate Silver has 538. There's that new Ezra Klein site called Vox. Now you've got this. But journalists always analyze data. Is data journalism the cutting edge in a different way than in the past?
I don't think this is a revolution. I think what's happened is that we have much more data available to us, and we can crunch it much more quickly, and that's happened at the same time that the Internet has, in a very good way, pushed journalism to be more plain-spoken and not using some of the linguistic conventions that we've used for many decades, right, in a fundamental shift that suggests fundamental changes. We're able to talk a little bit more directly to readers, which is in no way dumbed down. I think you put those two things together, and what we've discovered here is there is a huge hunger among readers for stuff that is deeply substantive, that goes into the data or the history and emerges with important patterns about major subjects, but is written in a way that a smart non-expert, a smart person who knew nothing about the subject before they arrived at the article, can understand. And for the experts, we're going to publish the data online, you know, a link or two away. So if they want to dig in, we invite them. All this data is online for this project, as for our Senate model. We invite people to dig in. Tell us what you think we missed. Tell us what stories are there that we didn't see.
David Leonhardt, editor of the New York Times section, The Upshot. David, we'll talk to you lots of times as you roll out more interesting stuff.
I look forward to it, Brian. Thank you.
As I know from your body of work that you will. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on the Supreme Court's affirmative action ruling yesterday. They said basically, white America, affirmative action's up to you. White America, go take a vote on it. It's okay. We'll explain.